That would have meant actually testing the trans-stage bus in flight, and that was just a little too dangerous. The covert nature of the project was far more important than the actual number of warheads those in authority had decided, and they could always correct it at a later date. They deliberately left the top end of the Russian design intact for that very reason, and for the moment, a total of 10 1-megaton warheads would have to do. One by one, the individual silos were opened by the support crew, and one by one, the oversized RVs were lifted off the flat car, set in place, then covered with their aerodynamic shrouds. Again, the Russian design served their purposes very well indeed. Each such operation took just over an hour, which allowed the entire procedure to be accomplished in a single night by the crew of 20. The silos were resealed, and it was done. Their country was now a nuclear power.
"Amazing," Goto observed.
"Actually very simple," Yamato replied.
"The government funded the fabrication and testing of the boosters as part of our space program. The plutonium came from the Monju reactor complex. Designing and building the warheads was child's play. If some Arabs can do a crude warhead in a cave in Lebanon, how hard can it be for our technicians?"
In fact, everything but the warhead fabrication process had been government-funded in one way or another, and Yamato was sure that the informal consortium that had done the latter would be compensated as well. Had they not done it all for their country?
"We will immediately commence training for the Self-Defense Force personnel to take over from our own people, once you assign them to us for that purpose, Goto-san."
"But the Americans and the Russians..." Yamato snorted.
"They are down to one missile each, and those will be officially blown up this week, as we will all see on television. As you know, their missile submarines have been deactivated. Their Trident missiles are already all gone, and the submarines are lined up awaiting dismantlement. A mere 10 working ICBMs gives us a marked strategic advantage."
"But what if they try to build more?"
"They can't. Not very easily," Yamato corrected himself. "The production lines have been closed down, and in accordance with the treaty, the tooling has all been destroyed under international inspection. To start over would take months, and we would find out very quickly. Our next important step is to launch a major naval construction program, for which Yamato's yards were ready, so that our supremacy in the Western Pacific will be unassailable. For the moment, with luck and the help of our friends, we will have enough to see us through. Before they will be able to challenge us, our strategic position will have improved to the point where they will have to accept our position and then treat us as equals."
"So, I must now give the order."
"Yes, Prime Minister," Yamato replied, again explaining to the man his job function.
Goto rubbed his hands together for a moment and looked down at the ornate desk so newly his. Ever the weak man, he temporized.
"Is it true? My Kimba was a drug addict."
Yamato nodded soberly, inwardly enraged at the remark.
"Very sad, is it not? My own chief of security, Kaneda, found her dead and called the police. It seems that she was very careful about it, but not careful enough."
Goto sighed quietly.
"Foolish child. Her father is a policeman, you know, a very stern man," she said. "He didn't understand her."
"I did," Goto said.
"She was a kind, gentle spirit. She would have made a fine geisha."
It was amazing how people transformed in death, Yamato thought coldly. That foolish, shameless girl had defied her parents and tried to make her own way in the world, only to find that the world was not tolerant of the unprepared. But because she had the ability to give Goto the illusion that he was a man, now she was a kind and gentle spirit.
"Goto-san, can we allow the fate of our nation to be decided by people like that?"
"No."
The new Prime Minister lifted his phone. He had to consult a sheet on his desk for the proper number.
"Climb Mount Niitaka," he said, when the connection was made, repeating an order that had been given more than 50 years earlier. In many ways the plane was singular, but in others quite ordinary. The VC-25B was, in fact, the Air Force's version of the venerable Boeing 747 airliner, a craft with fully 30 years of history in its design and still in serial production at the plant outside Seattle. It was painted in colors that had been chosen by a politically selected decorator to give the proper impression to foreign countries, whenever that was. Sitting alone on the concrete ramp, it was surrounded by uniformed security personnel, with authorization in the dry Pentagonese to use their M16 rifles far more readily than uniformed guards at most other federal installations. It was a more polite way of saying shoot first and ask questions later. There was no jetway. People had to climb stairs into the aircraft just as in the 1950s. But there was still a metal detector, and you still had to check your baggage, this time to Air Force and Secret Service personnel, who X-rayed everything and opened much of it for visual inspection. "I hope you left your Victoria's Secret stuff at home," Jack observed with a chuckle as he hoisted the last bag on the counter. "You'll find out when we get to Moscow," Professor Ryan replied with an impish wink. It was her first state trip, and everything at Andrews Air Force Base was new for her. "Hello, Dr. Ryan. We finally meet." Helen D'Agostino came over and extended her hand. "Kathy, this is the world's prettiest bodyguard," Jack said, introducing the Secret Service agent to his wife. "I couldn't make the last state dinner," Kathy explained. "There was a seminar up at Harvard." "Well, this trip ought to be pretty exciting," the Secret Service agent said, taking her leave smoothly to continue her duties. "Not as exciting as my last one," Jack thought, remembering another story that he couldn't relate to anyone. "Where'd she keep her gun?" Kathy asked. "I've never searched her for it, honey," Jack said with a wink of his own. "Do we go aboard now?" "I can go aboard whenever I want," her husband replied. "Color me important." "So much the better to board early and show her around," he decided, heading her toward the door. Designed to carry upwards of 300 passengers in its civilian incarnation, the President's personal 747, there was another backup aircraft, of course, was outfitted to hold a third of that number in stately comfort. Jack first showed his wife where they would be sitting, explaining that the pecking order was very clear. The closer you were to the front of the aircraft, the more important you were. The President's accommodations were in the nose, where two couches could convert into beds. The Ryans and the Van Dams would be in the next area, 20 feet or so aft, in a space that could seat 8, but only 5 in this case. Joining them would be the President's Director of Communications, a harried and usually frantic former TV executive named Tish Brown, recently divorced. Lesser staff members were sorted aft in diminishing importance until you got to the media, deemed less important still. "This is the kitchen?" Kathy asked. "Galley," Jack corrected. It was impressive, as were the meals prepared here, actually cooked from fresh ingredients and not reheated, as was the way on airliners. "It's bigger than ours," she observed, to the amused pleasure of the chief cook and Air Force Master Sergeant. "Not quite, but the chef's better, aren't you, Sarge?" "I'll turn my back now. You can slug him, ma'am. I won't tell." Kathy merely laughed at the jibe. "Why isn't he upstairs in the lounge?" "That's almost all communications gear. The President likes to wander up there to talk to the crew, but the guys who live there are mainly crippies."
"Crippies?"
"Communications guys," Jack explained, leading his wife back to their seats. The seats were beige leather, extra wide and extra soft, with recently added swing-up TV screens, personal phones, and other features which Kathy started to catalog, down to the presidential seal on the belt buckles.
"Now I know what first class really means."
"It's still an 11-hour flight, babe," Jack observed, settling in while others boarded. With luck, he'd be able to sleep most of the way. The President's televised departure statement followed its own pattern. The microphone was always set up so that Air Force One loomed in the background to remind everyone of who he was and to prove it by showing his personal plane. Roy Newton watched more for timing than anything else.
Statements like this never amounted to much, and only C-SPAN carried them at all, though the network newsies were always there with cameras in case the airplane blew up on takeoff. Concluding his remarks, Durling took his wife Anne by the arm and walked to the stairs where a sergeant saluted. At the door of the aircraft, the President and the First Lady turned to give a final wave, as though already on the campaign trail. In a very real way, this trip was part of that almost continuous process, then went inside. C-SPAN switched back to the floor of the House, where various junior members were giving brief speeches under special orders. The President would be in the air for 11 hours, Newton knew, more time than he needed. It was time to go to work. The ancient adage was true enough, he thought, arranging his notes. If more than one person knew it, it wasn't a secret at all. Even less so if you both knew part of it, and also knew who knew the rest, because then you could sit down over dinner and let on that you knew, and the other person would think that you knew it all, and would then tell you the parts you hadn't learned quite yet. The right smiles, nods, grunts, and a few carefully selected words would keep your source going until it was all there in plain sight. Newton supposed it was not terribly different for spies. Perhaps he would have been a good one. But it didn't pay any better than his stint in Congress, not even as well, in fact. And he'd long since decided to apply his talent to something that could make him a decent living. The rest of the game was a lot easier. You had to select the right person to give the information to, and that choice was made merely by reading the local papers carefully. Every reporter had a hot-button item, something for which he or she had a genuinely passionate interest, and for that reason reporters were no different from anyone else. If you knew what buttons to push, you could manipulate anyone. What a pity it hadn't quite worked with the people in his district, Newton thought, lifting the phone and punching the buttons. Libby Holtzman. Hi, Libby, this is Roy. How are things? A little slow, she allowed, wondering if her husband Bob would get anything good on the Moscow trip with the presidential party. How about dinner? He knew that her husband was away. What about? She asked. She knew it wasn't a tryst or something similarly foolish. Newton was a player and usually had something interesting to tell. It'll be worth your time, he promised. Jockey Club, 7:30? I'll be there. Newton smiled. It was all fair play, wasn't it? He'd lost his congressional seat on the strength of an accusation about influence peddling. It hadn't been strong enough to have merited prosecution. Someone else had influenced that. But it had been enough, barely, to persuade 50.7% of the voters in that off-year election that someone else should have the chance to represent them. In a presidential election year, Newton thought he would almost certainly have eked out a win. But congressional seats once lost are almost never regained. It could have been much worse. This life wasn't so bad, was it? He'd kept the same house, kept his kids in the same school, then moved them on to good colleges, kept his membership in the same country club. He just had a different constituency now. No ethics laws to trouble his mind about, not that they ever had, really. And it sure as hell paid a lot better, didn't it? Dateline Partners was being run out via computer satellite relay, three of them in fact. The Japanese Navy was linking all of its data to its fleet operations center in Yokohama. The U.S. Navy did the same into fleet ops at Pearl Harbor. Both headquarters offices used a third link to swap their own pictures. The umpires who scored the exercise in both locations thus had access to everything, but the individual fleet commanders did not. The purpose of the game was to give both sides realistic battle training, for which reason cheating was not encouraged. Cheating was a concept by turns foreign and integral with the fighting of wars, of course. Pacific Fleet's type commanders, the admirals in charge of the surface, air, submarine, and service forces respectively, watched from their chairs as the game unfolded, each wondering how his underlings would perform. Sato's no dummy, is he? Commander Chambers noted. The boy's got some beautiful moves, Dr. Jones opined. A senior contractor with his own special access clearance, he'd been allowed into the center on Mancuso's parole. But it isn't going to help him up north. Oh, Sub Pack turned and smiled. You know something I don't? The sonar departments on Charlotte and Nashville are damned good, Skipper. My people worked with them to set up the new tracking software, remember?
The COs aren't bad either, Mancuso pointed out.
Jones nodded agreement.
You bet, sir. They know how to listen, just like you did.
God, Chambers breathed, looking down at the new four-ring shoulder boards and imagining he could feel the added weight.
Admiral, you ever wonder how we would have made it without Jonesy here?
We had Chief Laval with us, remember? Mancuso said.
Frenchie's son is the lead sonarman on Asheville, Mr. Chambers.
For Jones, Mancuso would always be skipper, and Chambers would always be a lieutenant. Neither officer objected. It was one of the rules of the naval service that bonded officers and, in this case, former enlisted personnel.
I didn't know that, Sub Pack admitted.
Just joined up with her. He was on Tennessee before. Very sharp kid, made first class, 3 years out of his A school.
That's faster than you did it, Chambers observed. Is he that good?
Sure as hell. I'm trying to recruit him for my business. He got married last year and has a kid on the way. It shouldn't be too hard to bribe him out into civilian life.
Thanks a lot, Jonesy, Mancuso growled. I ought to kick your ass out of here.
Oh, come on, Skipper. When's the last time we got together for some real fun?
In addition to which, Jones' new whale-hunting software had been incorporated in what was left of the Pacific SOSIS system.
About time for an update.
The fact that both sides had observers in the other's headquarters was something of a complication, largely because there were assets and capabilities in both cases that were not, strictly speaking, shared. In this case, SOSIS generated traces that might or might not be the Japanese submarine force northwest of Kure were actually better than what appeared on the main plotting board. The real traces were given to Mancuso and Chambers. Each side had two submarines. Neither American boat showed up on the traces, but the Japanese boats were conventionally powered and had to go periodically to snorkeling depth in order to run their diesels and recharge their batteries. Though the Japanese submarines had their own version of the American Prairie Masker systems, Jones' new software had gone a long way to defeat that countermeasure. Mancuso and the rest retired to the Sub-Pack's plotting room to examine the newest data.
Okay, Jonesy, tell me what you see, Mancuso ordered, looking at the paper printouts from the underwater hydrophones that littered the bottom of the Pacific.
The data was displayed both electronically on TV-type displays and on fan-folded paper of the sort once used for computer printouts for more detailed analysis. For work like this, the latter was preferred, and there were two sets. One of them had already been marked up by the oceanographic technicians of the local SOSIS detachment. To make this a double-blind analysis and to see if Jones still knew how, Mancuso kept separate the set already analyzed by his people. Still short of 40, Jones had gray already in his thick dark hair, though he chewed gum now instead of smoking. The intensity was still there, Mancuso saw. Dr. Ron Jones flipped pages like an accountant on the trail of embezzlement, his finger tracing down the vertical lines on which frequencies were recorded.
"We assume that they'll snort every 8 hours or so?" he asked.
"That's a smart thing to keep their batteries fully charged," Chambers agreed with a nod.
"What time are they operating on?" Jones asked.
"Typically, American submarines at sea adjusted their clocks to Greenwich Mean Time, recently changed to Universal Time, with the diminution of the Royal Navy, whose power had once allowed the prime meridian to be defined by the British."
"I presume Tokyo," Mancuso replied. "That's us minus 5.
So we start looking for patterns, midnight and even hours their time."
There were 5 of the wide-folded sheets. Jones flipped one complete set at a time, noting the time references in the margins. It took him 10 minutes.
"Here's one, and here's another. These two are possible. This one's also possible, but I don't think so. I'll put money down on this one, and this one for starters." His fingers tapped on seemingly random lines of dots.
"Wally?" Chambers turned to the other table and flipped the marked-up sets to the proper time settings.
"Jonesy, you fucking witch," he breathed. It had taken a team of skilled technicians, experts all, over 2 hours to do what Jones had accomplished in a few minutes before their again incredulous eyes. The civilian contractor pulled a can of Coke from the nearby cooler and popped it open. "Gentlemen," he asked, "who's the all-time champ?" That was only part of it, of course. The printouts merely gave bearing to a suspected noise source, but there were several of the bottom-sighted SOSIS arrays, and triangulation had already been accomplished, nailing the datum points down to radii of 10 to 15 nautical miles. Even with Jones's improvements in the system, that still left a lot of ocean to search. The phone rang. It was Commander-in-Chief Pacific Fleet. Mancuso took the call and made his recommendations for vectoring Charlotte and Asheville onto the suspected contacts. Jones observed the exchange and nodded approval. "See what I mean, Skipper? You always did know how to listen." Murray had been out discussing a few budgetary matters with the assistant director in charge of the Washington field office, therefore missing the phone call. The top-secret dispatch from the White House was tucked away in secure files, and then his secretary had been called out to bring a sick child home from school. As a result, the handwritten message from Ryan had been unconscionably late in coming to his attention. "The Norton girl," he said, walking into Director Shaw's office. "Bad? Dead," Murray said, handing the paper over. Shaw scanned it quickly. "Shit," the FBI director whispered. "Did she have a prior history of drug use?" "Not that I recall." "Word from Tokyo?" "I haven't checked it with the legat yet. Bad timing for that, Bill." Shaw nodded, and the thought in his mind was transparent. Ask any FBI agent for the case he bragged about, and it is always kidnapping. It was really how the Bureau had made its name back in the 1930s. The Lindbergh Law had empowered the FBI to assist any local police force as soon as the possibility existed that the victim could have been taken across a state line. With the mere possibility, the victims were rarely actually transported so far, the whole weight and power of America's premier law enforcement agency descended on the case like a pack of especially hungry wolves. The real mission was always the same, to get the victim back alive, and there the results were excellent. The secondary objective was to apprehend, charge, and try the subjects in question, and there the record, statistically speaking, was better still. They didn't know yet if Kimberly Norton had been a kidnap victim. They did know that she would be coming home dead. That single fact, for any FBI agent, was a professional failure. "Her father's a cop. I remember, Dan. I want to go out there and talk it over with O'Keefe." Part of it was because Captain Norton deserved to hear it from other cops, not through the media. Part of it was because the cops on the case had to do it, to admit their failure to him. And part of it would be for Murray to take a look at the case file himself, to be sure for himself that all that might have been done had been done. "I can probably spare you for a day or two," Shaw replied. "The Linders case is going to wait until the President gets back anyway." "Okay. Get packed." "This is better than the Concorde," Kathy gushed at the Air Force corporal who served dinner. Her husband almost laughed. It wasn't often that Carolyn Ryan's eyes went quite so wide, but then he was long accustomed to this sort of service, and the food was certainly better than she customarily ate in the Hopkins Physician's Dining Room. And there the plates didn't have gold trim, one of the reasons that Air Force One had so much pilferage. "Wine for Madam?" Ryan lifted the bottle of Russian River Chardonnay and poured as his plate came down. "We don't drink wine on the chicken farm, you see," she told the corporal with a small measure of embarrassment. "Everybody's this way the first time, Dr. Ryan. If you need anything, please buzz me." She headed back to the galley. "See, Kathy? I told you. Stick with me." "I wondered how you got used to flying," she noted, tasting the broccoli. "Fresh. The flight crew's pretty good, too." He gestured to the wine glasses, not a ripple. "The pay isn't all that great," Arnie Van Dam said from the other side of the compartment. "But the perks ain't too bad." The blackened redfish isn't bad at all.
Our chef stole the recipe from the Jockey Club, best Cajun redfish in town, Van Dam explained. I think he had to trade his potato soup for it.
Fair deal, Arnie judged.
He gets the crust just right, doesn't he? One of Washington's few really excellent restaurants, the Jockey Club was located in the basement of the Ritz-Carlton Hotel on Massachusetts Avenue. A quiet, dimly lit establishment, it had for many years been a place for power meals of one sort or another.
All the food here is good, Libby Holtzman thought, especially when someone else paid for it.
The previous hour had handled all manner of small talk, the usual exchange of information and gossip that was even more important in Washington than most American cities. That was over now. The wine was served, the salad plates gone, and the main course on the table.
So, Roy, what's the big item?
Ed Keelty. Newton looked up to watch her eyes. Don't tell me his wife's finally going to leave the rat.
He's probably going to be the one leaving, as a matter of fact.
Who's the unlucky bimbo? Mrs. Holtzman asked with a wry smile.
Not what you think, Libby. Ed's going away.
You always wanted to make them wait for it.
Roy, it's 8:30, okay? Libby observed, making her position clear.
The FBI has a case running on Keelty. Rape. More than one, in fact. One of the victims killed herself.
Lisa Berenger?
The reason for her suicide had never been adequately explained. She left a letter behind. The FBI has it now. They also have several other women who are willing to testify.
Wow,
Libby Holtzman allowed herself to say. She set her fork down.
How solid is this?
The man running the case is Dan Murray, Shaw's personal attack dog.
I know Dan. I also know he won't talk about this.
You rarely got an FBI agent to discuss evidentiary matters in a criminal case, certainly not before it was presented. That sort of leak almost always came from an attorney or court clerk. He doesn't just do things by the book. He wrote the book. It was literally true. Murray had helped draft many of the Bureau's official procedures. He might this one time.
Why, Roy?
Because Durling is holding things up. He thinks he needs Keelty for his clout on the Hill. You notice that Eddie Boy's been in the White House a lot lately? Durling spilled it all to him so that he can firm up his defense, at least, Newton said to cover himself. That's what people are telling me. It does seem a little out of character, doesn't it?
Obstruction of justice?
That's the legal term, Libby. Technically speaking, well, I'm not quite sure it meets the legal test. Now the hook was well in the water, and the bait worm was wiggling very nicely.
What if he was just holding it off to keep it from competing with the trade bill?
The fish was giving it a look, but wondering about the shiny barbed thing behind the worm. This one goes back further than that, Libby. They've been sitting on it for quite a while, that's what I hear. It does make a great excuse, though, doesn't it? It was a very enticing worm, though.
If you think politics takes precedence over a sexual assault case, how solid is the case?
If it goes in front of a jury, Ed Keelty is going to spend time in a federal penitentiary.
That's solid?
My, what a juicy fat worm it was.
Like you said, Murray's a good cop.
Who's the U.S. attorney on the case?
Ann Cooper.
She's been full-time on this for weeks. One hell of a good worm, in fact. That barbed, shiny thing wasn't all that dangerous, was it?
Newton took an envelope from his pocket and set it on the tablecloth.
Names, numbers, details, but you didn't get them from me, okay?
The worm appeared to dance in the water, and it was no longer apparent that the hook was the thing really moving.
What if I can't verify anything? Then there's no story, and my sources are wrong, and I hope you enjoyed dinner.
Of course, the worm might just go away.
Why, Roy? Why you? Why the story?
Circling, circling. But how did this worm ever get here?
I never liked the guy, you know that. We butted heads on two big irrigation bills, and he killed a defense project in my state.
But you really want to know why? I have daughters, Libby. One's a senior at UPenn, another one's just starting University of Chicago Law School. They both want to follow in their dad's footsteps, and I don't want my little girl staffing on the Hill with bastards like Ed Kielty around. Who really cared how the worm got in the water anyway? With a knowing nod, Libby Holtzman took the envelope. It went into her purse without being opened. Amazing how they never noticed the hook until it was too late. Sometimes not even then. The waiter was disappointed when both diners passed on the dessert card, settling for just a quick espresso before paying the bill. "Hello?" Barbara Linders, a female voice asked. "Yes, who's this?" "Libby Holtzman from the Post. I live a few blocks away from you. I'd like to know if I might come over and talk about a few things." "What things?" "Ed Kielty, and why they've decided not to prosecute the case."
"They what?"
"That's what we're hearing," the voice told her. "Wait a minute, they warned me about this," Linders said suspiciously, already giving part of the game away. "They always warn you about something, usually the wrong thing. Remember, I was the one who did the story last year about Congressman Grant and that nasty little thing he had going on in his district office. And I was also the one who nailed that bastard undersecretary in Interior. I keep a close eye on cases like this, Barbara," the voice said, sister to sister. It was true. Libby Holtzman had nearly bagged a Pulitzer for her reporting on political sex abuse cases. "How do I know it's really you?" "You've seen me on TV, right? Ask me over and you'll see. I can be there in 5 minutes. I'm going to call Mr. Murray." "That's fine. Go ahead and call him. But promise me one thing." "What's that?" "If he tells you the same thing about why they're not doing anything, then we can talk." The voice paused. "In fact, how about I come over right now anyway? If Dan tells you the right thing, we can just have a cup of coffee and do some background stuff for later. Fair enough?" "Okay. I guess that's okay. I have to call Mr. Murray now." Barbara Linders hung up and dialed another number from memory. "Hi, this is Dan. Mr. Murray," Barbara said urgently, her faith in the world so badly shaken. "And this is Liz," another voice said, obviously now on tape. "We can't come to the phone right now," both voices said together. "Where are you when I need you?" Ms. Linders demanded of the recording machine, hanging up in a despairing fury before the humorous recording delivered her to the beep. Was it possible? Could it be true? "This is Washington," her experience told her. Anything could be true. Barbara Linders looked around the room. She'd been in Washington for 11 years. What did she have to show for it? A one-bedroom apartment with prints on the wall. Nice furniture that she used alone. Memories that threatened her sanity. She was so alone. So damned alone with them, and she had to let them go, get them out, strike back at the man who had wrecked her life so thoroughly, and now that would be denied her too? Was it possible? The most frightening thing of all was that Lisa had felt this way. She knew that from the letter she'd kept, a photocopy of which was still in the jewelry box on her bureau. She'd kept it both as a keepsake of her best friend and to remind herself not to go as dangerously far into despair as Lisa had. Reading the letter a few months ago had persuaded her to open up to her gynecologist, who had in turn referred her to Clarice Golden, starting the process that had led her... where? The door buzzed then, and Barbara went to answer it. "Hi, recognize me?" The question was delivered with a warm and sympathetic smile. Libby Holtzman was a tall woman with thick ebony hair that framed a pale face and warm brown eyes. "Please come in," Barbara said, backing away from the door. "Did you call Dan?" "He wasn't home, or maybe he just left the machine on," Barbara thought. "You know him?" "Oh, yes, Dan's an acquaintance," Libby said, heading toward the couch. "Can I trust him? I mean, really trust him?" "Honestly?" Holtzman paused. "Yes, if he were running the case all by himself, yes, you could. Dan's a good man. I mean that." "But he's not running the case by himself, is he?" Libby shook her head. It's too big, too political. The other thing about Murray is, well, he's a very loyal man. He does what he's told. Can I sit down, Barbara? Please. Both sat on the couch. You know what the press does? It's our job to keep an eye on things. I like Dan. I admire him. He really is a good cop, an honest cop, and I'll bet you that everything he's done with you, well, he's acted like your big tough brother, hasn't he? Every step of the way, Barbara confirmed. He's been my best friend in all the world. That wasn't a lie. He's one of the good guys. I know his wife Liz, too. The problem is not everyone is like Dan, and that's where we come in, Libby told her. What do you mean? When somebody tells a guy like Dan what he has to do, mostly they do it. They do it because they have to, because that's what the rules are. And you know something, he hates it almost as much as you do. My job, Barbara, is to help people like Dan, because I can get the bastards off their backs, too. I can't. I mean, I just can't. Libby reached out and stopped her with a gentle touch on the hand. I'm not going to ask you to give me anything on the record, Barbara. That could mess up the criminal case, and you know I want this one to be handled through the system just as much as you do. But can you talk to me off the record?
Yes, I think so.
Do you mind if I record this? The reporter pulled a small recorder from her purse.
Who will hear it?
The only other person will be my AME, Assistant Managing Editor. We do that to make sure that we have good sources. Except for that, it's like talking to your lawyer, a doctor, or minister. Those are the rules, and we never break them. Intellectually speaking, Barbara knew that, but here and now in her apartment, the ethical rules of journalism seemed a thin reed. Libby Holtzman could see it in her eyes. If you want, I can just leave, or we can talk without the recorder, but a disarming smile. I hate taking shorthand. You make mistakes that way. If you want to think about it a little while, that's okay, too. You had enough pressure. I know that. I know what this can be like.
That's what Dan says, but he doesn't. He doesn't, really.
Libby Holtzman looked straight into her eyes. She wondered if Murray had seen the same pain and felt it as deeply as she did now. Probably so, she thought quite honestly. Probably in a slightly different way, because he was a man, but he was a good cop, and he was probably just as mad about the way the case was going as she now felt. Barbara, if you just want to talk about things, that's okay, too. Sometimes we just need a friend to talk to. I don't have to be a reporter all the time.
Do you know about Lisa?
Her death was never really explained, was it?
We were best friends. We shared everything. And then, when he...
Are you sure Keelty was involved with that?
I'm the one who found the letter, Libby.
What can you tell me about that? Holtzman asked, unable to restrain her journalistic focus now.
I can do better than tell you.
Linders rose and disappeared for a moment. She returned with the photocopies and handed them over. It only took 2 minutes to read the letter once and then once again. Date, place, method. A message from beyond the grave, Libby thought. What was more dangerous than ink on paper?
For what's on here, and what you know, he could go to prison, Barbara.
That's what Dan says. He smiles when he says it. He wants it to happen. Do you? Holtzman asked.
Yes.
Then let me help. Chapter 17 Strike 1 It's called the miracle of modern communications only because nothing modern is supposed to be a curse. In fact, those on the receiving end of such information were often appalled by what they got. It had been a smooth flight, even by the standards of Air Force One, on which many passengers, mainly the younger and more foolish White House staffers, often refused to buckle their seatbelts as a show of... something, Ryan thought. The Air Force flight crew was as good as any he knew, but it hadn't prevented one incident on final at Andrews where a thunderbolt had blown the nose cone off the aircraft carrying the Secretary of Defense and his wife, rather to everyone's discomfiture, and so he always kept his belt on, albeit loosely, just as the flight crew did. "Dr. Ryan?" The whisper was accompanied by a shake of his shoulders. "What is it, Sarge?" There was no sense in grumbling at an innocent NCO. "Mr. Van Dam needs you upstairs, sir." Jack nodded and moved his seat to the upright position. The sergeant handed him a coffee mug on the way. A clock told him it was 9 a.m, but it didn't say where it was 9 a.m, and Ryan could not at the moment remember what zone the clock was set on. It was all theoretical anyway. How many time zones could dance inside an airliner? The upper deck of the VC-25B contrasted sharply with the lower deck. Instead of plush appointments, the compartment here was lined with military-style electronics gear whose individual boxes had chromed bars for easy removal and replacement. A sizable team of communications specialists was always at work, tapped into every source of information one might imagine. Digital radio, TV, and fax, every single channel encrypted. Arnie Van Dam stood in the middle of the area and handed something over. It turned out to be a facsimile copy of the Washington Post's late edition, about to hit the streets 4,000 miles and 6 hours away. "Vice President implicated in suicide," the four-column headline announced. "Five women charge Edward Keelty with sexual abuse." "You woke me up for this?" Ryan asked. It was nowhere near his area of responsibility, was it? "You're named in the story," Arnie told him. "What?" Jack scanned the piece. "National Security Advisor Ryan is one of those briefed in on the affair." "Okay, I guess that's true, isn't it?" "Keep going. The White House told the FBI 4 weeks ago not to present the case to the Judiciary Committee." "That's not true." "This one's a beautiful combination of what is and what isn't." The chief of staff was in an even fouler mood than Ryan. "Who leaked?" "I don't know, but Libby Holtzman ran this piece, and her husband is sleeping aft. He likes you. Get him and talk to him." "Wait a minute. This is something that a little time and truth will settle out, Arnie. The president hasn't done anything wrong that I know about." "His political enemies can call the delay obstruction of justice." "Come on," Jack shook his head in disbelief. "No way that would stand up to examination." "It doesn't have to, damn it. We're talking politics, remember, not facts, and we have elections coming up. Talk to Bob Holtzman. Now," Van Dam ordered. He didn't do it often with Ryan, but he did have the authority. "Tell the boss yet?" Jack asked, folding up his copy. "We'll let him sleep for a while. Send Tish up, by the way, will you?" "Okay." Ryan headed back down and shook Tish Brown awake, pointing upstairs, then headed aft to a flight attendant. "Crew member," he corrected himself. "Get Bob Holtzman up here, will you?" Through an open port, he could see that it was light outside. Maybe it was 9 o'clock where they were going. Yeah, they were scheduled to arrive in Moscow at 2 p.m. local time. The head cook was sitting in his galley reading a copy of Time. Ryan went in and got his own coffee refill. "Can't sleep, Dr. Ryan?" "Not anymore. Duty calls." "I have rolls baking if you want." "Great idea." "What is it?" Bob Holtzman asked, sticking his head in. Like every man aboard at the moment, he needed a shave. Jack merely handed over the story. "What gives?" Holtzman was a fast reader. "Jesus, is this true?" "How long has Libby been on this one?" "It's news to me." "Oh, shit. Sorry, Jack." Ryan nodded with more smile than he felt. "Yeah, I just woke up, too." "Is it true?" "This is on background." "Agreed." "The FBI's been running the case for some time now. The dates in Libby's piece are close, and I'd have to check my office logs for the exact ones. I got briefed in right around the time the trade thing blew up because of Keelty's security clearance. What I can tell him, what I can't. You know how that goes, right?" "Yes, I understand. So what's the status of the case?" "The chairman and ranking member of Judiciary have been briefed in. So have Al Trent and Sam Fellows on intelligence. Nobody's putting a stopper on this one, Bob. To the best of my knowledge, the president's played a straight game the whole way. Guilty's going down, and after the impeachment proceedings, if it goes that far...
It has to go that far, Holtzman pointed out.
I doubt it, Ryan shook his head. If he gets a good lawyer, they'll cut some sort of deal. They have to, like it was with Agnew. If he goes through impeachment and then a Senate trial, God help him in front of a jury.
Makes sense, Holtzman conceded.
You're telling me the meat of the story's wrong?
Correct.
If there's any obstruction going on, I don't know about it, and I have been briefed in on this.
Have you spoken with Keelty?
No, nothing substantive. On business stuff, I brief his national security guys, and he briefs his boss. I wouldn't be good at that, would I? Two daughters?
So, you know about the facts of the case?
Not the specifics, no. I don't need to know. I do know Murray pretty well. If Dan says the case is solid, well, then I figure it is.
Ryan finished off the rest of his coffee and reached for a fresh roll.
The president is not obstructing this one. It's been delayed so it wouldn't conflict with other things, that's all.
You're not supposed to do that either, you know, Holtzman pointed out, getting one for himself.
God damn it, Bob. Prosecutors schedule cases, too, don't they? All this is scheduling.
Holtzman read Jack's face and nodded.
I'll pass that one along.
It was already too late for proper damage control. Most of the political players in Washington are early risers. They have their coffee, read their papers in great detail, check their fax machines for additional material, and often take early phone calls, or in a recent development, log on to computer services to check electronic mail, all in an effort to leave their homes with a good feel for the shape the new day will take. In the case of many members, facsimile copies of the late edition story by Liz Holtzman had brief cover pages indicating that this might be a matter of great personal interest. Different code phrases were used depending on which PR firm had originated the transmission, but all were the same. The members in question had been compelled to mute their opposition to TRA. This opportunity, on the other hand, was seen as something of a payback for the earlier transgression. In few cases would the opportunity be missed. The comments were mainly delivered off the record. "This looks like a very serious matter," was the phrase most often used. "It's unfortunate that the president saw fit to interfere in a criminal matter," was another favorite. Early calls to Director William Shaw of the FBI were met with no comments, usually with the additional clarification that the policy of the FBI was to decline comment on any possible criminal case, lest the subsequent legal proceedings be tainted and the rights of the accused compromised. The clarification was rarely, if ever, conveyed to the public. In that way, no comment acquired its own very special spin. The accused in this case awoke in his house on the grounds of the Naval Observatory on Massachusetts Avenue Northwest to find his senior aides downstairs and waiting for him.
"Oh, shit," Ed Keelty observed. It was all he had to say. There was little point in denying the story. His people knew him too well for that. He was a man of an amorous nature, they all rationalized, a trait not uncommon in public life, though he was fairly discreet about it.
"Lisa Berenger," the vice president breathed, reading, "Can't they let the poor girl rest in peace?"
He remembered the shock of her death, the way she'd died, slipping off her seatbelt and driving into a bridge abutment at 90 miles per hour, how the medical examiner had related the inefficiency of the method. She'd taken several minutes to die, still alive and whimpering when the paramedics had arrived. Such a sweet, nice kid. She just hadn't understood how things were. She'd wanted too much back from him. Maybe she'd thought that it was different with her. Well, Keelty thought, everybody thought they were different.
"He's hanging you out to dry," Keelty's senior aide observed. The important part of this, after all, was the political vulnerability of their principal.
"Sure as hell, the son of a bitch," the vice president thought, "after all the things I've done."
"Okay, ideas."
"Well, of course, we deny everything. Indignantly at that," his chief of staff began, handing over a sheet of paper. "I have a press release, for starters. Then we will have a press conference before noon." He'd already called half a dozen former and current female staffers who would stand beside their boss. In every case, it was a woman whose bed he had graced with his presence and who remembered the time with a smile. Great men had flaws, too. In Edward Keelty's case, the flaws were more than balanced by his commitment to the things that mattered. Keelty read quickly down the page. "The only defense against a completely false accusation is the truth. There is no basis in fact whatever to these accusations. My public record is well known, as is my support for women's and minority rights. I request," demand was the wrong word to use, his personal counsel thought, "an immediate airing of the allegations and the opportunity to defend myself vigorously, clearly no coincidence with the upcoming election year. Regret that such a groundless accusation will affect our great President Roger Durling. Get that son of a bitch on the phone right now. Bad time for a confrontation, Mr. Vice President. You fully expect his support, remember?" "Oh, yes I do, don't I?" That part of the release wouldn't so much be a warning shot across the bow as one aimed right at the bridge, Keelty thought. Either Durling would support him or else risk political meltdown in the primaries. What else would happen this year? Though too late to catch the morning papers in most of America, too late even for USA Today, the Keelty story had been caught by the broadcast media as part of their own pre-show media surveys. For many in the investment community, that meant National Public Radio's morning edition show, a good program to listen to during the drives from New Jersey and Connecticut because of its repeating two-hour length. A copyrighted story in this morning's Washington Post, the coverage on it began at the top of both hourly segments, with a preamble like a warning bell to get the listener's attention. And though political stories out of Washington were about as common as the local weather report, rape and suicide were words with unequivocal meaning. Shit, 1,000 or so voices breathed simultaneously in the same number of expensive automobiles. What else is going to happen? The volatility of the market had not ended yet, and something like this was sure to exert the kind of downward pressure that never really made any economic sense, but was so real that everyone knew it would happen, and because of that planned for it, and because of that made it even more real in what computer engineers called a feedback loop. The market would drop again today. It had trended down for 11 of the past 14 days, and though the Dow was replete with bargains by any technical measure, the little guys would make their nervous sell orders and the mutual funds, driven by calls from more little guys, would do the same, adding institutional momentum to a totally artificial situation. The entire system was called a true democracy, but if it was, then a herd of nervous cattle was a democracy too. Okay, Arnie, President Durling didn't bother asking who had leaked it. He was a sufficiently sophisticated player in the game that he knew it didn't matter. What do we do? I talked to Bob Holtzman, Ryan told the boss, prompted by a look from the chief of staff. And I think he believed me. Hell, I was telling the truth, wasn't I? It was a question rather than a rhetorical expression. Yes, you were, Jack. Ed's going to have to handle this one himself. The relief on Ryan's face was so obvious as to offend the chief executive. Did you think I was really going to do this? Of course not, Ryan answered at once. Who knows? On the airplane? Van Dam asked. I'm sure Bob spread it around some. Well, let's clobber it right now. Tish, Durling said to his communications director, let's get a release put together. The Judiciary Committee's been briefed in, and I have not put any pressure on them at all. What do we say about the delay? Tish Brown asked. We decided jointly with the leadership that the matter deserved to have... What? The president looked up at the ceiling. It deserved to have a clear field. Sufficiently serious... No, it is sufficiently important to deserve a Congress undistracted by other considerations, Ryan offered. Not bad, he thought. I'll make a politician out of you yet, Durling said with a grudging smile. You're not going to say anything directly about the case, Van Dam went on, giving the president advice in the form of an order. I know. I can't say anything on the facts of the matter because I can't allow myself to interfere with the proceedings or Keelty's defense. except to say that any citizen is innocent until the facts demonstrate otherwise. America is founded on and all that stuff. Tish, write it up. I'll deliver it on the airplane before we land. And then maybe we can do what we're supposed to be doing. Anything else? Durling asked. Secretary Hansen reports that everything's set up. No surprises, Ryan said, finally getting to his own briefing. Secretary Fiedler has the monetary support agreement ready for initialing, too. On that end, sir, it's going to be a nice, smooth visit. How reassuring that is, the president observed dryly. Okay, let me get cleaned up. Air Force One or not, traveling in such close proximity to others was rarely comfortable. Presidential privacy was a tenuous commodity under the best of circumstances, but at least in the White House you had real walls between yourself and others, not here. An Air Force sergeant strained at his leash to lay out Durling's clothing and shaving things. The man had already spent 2 hours turning the presidential shoes from black leather into chrome, and it would have been ungracious to push the guy off. People were so damned eager to show their loyalty. Except for the ones you needed to, Durling thought as he entered the small washroom. We got more 'em. Sanchez emerged from the head adjacent to CIC to see people gathered around the central plotting table. There were now three groups of the diamond shapes that denoted enemy surface ships. Charlotte, moreover, had position on a V-shape that meant an enemy submarine, and Asheville supposedly had a good sniff also. Best of all, the joint patrol line of S-3 Viking ASW aircraft 200 miles in advance of the battle group had identified what appeared to be a patrol line of other submarines. Two had been caught snorting, one on Sosus and one by Sonoboys, and using a line defined by those two positions, two others had been found. Now they even had a predictable interval between boats for the aircraft to concentrate on. "Sunset tomorrow?" the CAG asked. "They like the rising sun, don't they? Let's catch 'em at dinner, then." "Fine with me." Sanchez lifted the phone at his place to alert his wing operations officer. "Takes long enough," Jones murmured. "I seem to remember when you were able to stand watches for a real long time," Wally Chambers told the civilian. "I was young and dumb then. I smoked, too," he remembered. "Such good things for concentration and alertness. But most submarines didn't allow people to smoke at all. Amazing that some crews hadn't mutinied. What was the Navy coming to? See what I told you about my software? You telling us that even you can be replaced by a computer?" The contractor's head turned. "You know, Mr. Chambers, as you get older, you have to watch the coffee intake." "You two going at it again?" Admiral Mancuso rejoined them after shaving in the nearby head. "I think Jonesy was planning to hit Banzai Beach this afternoon," Captain Chambers chuckled, sipping at his decaf. "He's getting bored with the exercise." "They do take a while," Sub-Pac confirmed. "Hey, guys, we're validating my product, aren't we?" "If you want some insider information, yeah. I'm going to recommend you get the contract." Not the least reason for which was that Jones had underbid IBM by a good 20%. "Next step, I just hired two guys from Woods Hole. That never occurred to the suits at Big Blue." "What do you mean?" "We're going to decode whale talk, now that we can hear it so much better. Greenpeace is going to love us. The submarine mission for the next decade, making the seas safe for our fellow mammals. We can also track those Jap bastards who hunt them." "What do you mean?" Chambers asked. "You want funding? I have an idea that'll keep it for you." "What's that, Jonesy?" Mancuso asked. "The Woods Hole guys think they have the alarm calls for three species identified, for humpback, fins, and says. They got them by listening in with hydrophones while they were hanging out with whalers. I can program that for active. It's in the freak range we transmit on. So what we can do is have the subs trail along with the whalers and broadcast the call. And guess what? The whalers won't find shit. No whale in his right mind will get within 20 miles of another whale screaming that he's being mugged. Not much solidarity in the cetacean community."
You turning tree-hugger on us? Chambers wondered, but he thought about it and nodded slowly. All those people have to tell their friends in Congress is that we're doing good scientific work. Okay, not that they love us, not that they approve of our power plants, just that we're doing good work. What I'm giving you guys is a mission for the next 10 years. Jones was also giving his company work for at least that long, but that was beside the point. Mancuso and the submarine community needed